You fellas want to read me my rights?
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 195. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastic. How are you?
Good. It is a troubleshooting Windows 10 BS audio kind of day. I'm sure everybody feels it. But enough of all that, which I believe we have fixed, by the way. Yep. Enough of all that. This was one hell of an insane... I mean, we say that a lot, but like this week, wow. Wow. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there are a few things to cover. I think we've got it. We've got at least the bare minimum under control. You know, last week we gave you two 90-minute episodes. We're going to try and not go a full 90 minutes today, but the longer we do this pre-show, the higher the risk.
I was going to say
we
better get to it. You know, don't say we never did anything for you, listeners, because you got three shows essentially last week. But we better get to it because there's so much to do. But, you know, we got a couple things. I just meant to say this last week, so it's a little out of time now. But I was just going to recommend over on Serious Inquiries Only, I had two really, really powerful interviews in back to back that I just was, I just really wanted to see if people wanted to check them out with Callie Wright. And then Zarin Feroz, and with Callie, it was a very compelling discussion about her life as a trans person and so much more. And then with Zarin is an example of 70 billion ways why Trump is harming people. I mean, she's an immigrant, although right now she's applying for asylum and she's not able to get it. She's an ex-Muslim. She also needs health care and can't get, like, it was a million things that just were all intersected with how Trump and the Republican agenda is hurting people. And I thought it was a very powerful interview. So I just wanted to recommend those if people wanted to check those out.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with both of that. Obviously, I've been a big fan of Callie's for a long time, and I thought that interview was fantastic, and I love her story, and I love her work. And this was my first exposure to Zarin, and I'm really glad that you brought her story to light. So I wholeheartedly endorse that. We'll link those in the show notes. Head on over and check those two episodes out.
And then once again, we're already at the end of another month. I just can't even believe how fast this goes. So that means we've got the goodies coming up for you, patrons. We've got the live Q&A. Andrew already has the question thread going there, although he never looks at the questions because it's a rapid fire kind of thing. But it's up there on patreon.com/law for you to participate. And that live Q&A, reminder, only patrons get to ask questions on the thread. That's kind of a patron perk, but we want to open it up to everybody to watch. It's been really fun. People have been joining us. So, hey, put this in your calendars, folks. Tuesday, the 31st, coming up. It's going to be 4 Pacific, 7 Eastern. We're going to do that live Q&A. Come watch. It really is one of the most fun things that we do on this show. Everybody has a good time. The people in the chat interact with each other and ask questions, and it's super fun. So don't miss that. And then also, Lot Awful Movies will come at you very soon. So we got to get to it. Enough of this pre-show announcement stuff. What in the world? So much to talk about. But first, we've got to go to a listener question.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions. What?
Listener question from Sandro LaBarbara. On OA-194, you advised the kid who is a summer intern not to do anything that could harm their internship because A, they can't challenge the chain of command, B, the change proposed won't take place, and C, the older, more powerful people ultimately know better or can practically accomplish more no matter what. I don't remember that point exactly. Basically, I felt the advice was wait till you can go from enduring having to do something you deem dishonest to enjoying doing it when you're finally the one who gets paid most through that process. Oh, that's not the most charitable portrayal, but okay. Such a point of view, if left unchallenged, may well sound patriarchal, entitled, hierarchical, and ultimately anti-civic. Wow, well, that's a mess. What do you have to say for yourself, Andrew? I don't really agree with the characterization in C, but what do you have to say?
Yeah, I wanted to tackle Sandra's question because if anybody got that sense from my answer to the question in OA-194, I wanted very clearly to clarify that, right? So let me be specific about this. When I was answering the question, and just as a callback, if you haven't heard OA-194, we had somebody who was a first-year law student, summer internship for a firm, was asked to put together some sources for a potential expert witness, and was instructed by the partner to compile sources from naturopaths and other sources that the listener writing in felt was quackery, and said, basically, you know, I feel like there's an ethical obligation here not to engage in quackery. And I wanted to do two things, right? So the principal thing I wanted to do was describe the reality of life at a big firm. And related to that,
right,
I got a comment.
You were describing it, not defending it per se.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah,
like
in no way.
Big firm.
Yeah, and let me be super clear about this, right? You shouldn't be taking legal advice from a podcast. I don't know that you should be taking ethical advice from this podcast. But I'll say it this way: never, in no way is this show suggesting that you should do something that makes you feel ethically compromised to, you know, keep your job, right? It's what I want you to know is, what are the likely consequences and of undertaking an action here? And so, you know, so I talked about the reality of what life is like at a big firm. So actually, I got an email on the other side of this from listener Julia, who I believe is a lawyer, who says, to get right to my point, on what planet are you living where summer associates speak directly with clients? And yeah, right. So, you know, that's the way in which summer associates are viewed inside a law firm, right? You are an expense, not a profit center. And so you should know the consequences of taking a particular ethical stand. And you should know, particularly when you're asked to gather information, that taking that stand is very unlikely to affect how the case moves forward to the point of, you know, virtually zero. But in no way did I mean to kind of connect up the last thing that says, you know, if you feel like you can't turn over a report that contains, you know, the opining of a naturopath, and, you know, you didn't follow my suggestion regarding presenting it as cross-examination and all of that, you know, you that choice is yours. And I want to emphasize, right, like, so I talked on that side, but when I was at Covington and Burling, there were multiple instances where I had presented before me the opportunity to do work that I did not ethically want to do. Okay. And those came in two forms, right? The first was I was approached and asked by a partner that I liked and that I did a fair amount of work for to do work on behalf of the American Tobacco Institute, right? And I said, you know, I'm not super comfortable with that. And they said, okay, fine. And they found somebody else to do the work. And the second thing, and this was a much more direct relationship. I worked for Bobby Birchfield, who is a terrific, brilliant, very right-wing lawyer who was in charge of, from the Covington and Burling perspective, heading up the 2000 recount for Team George W. Bush. So I was invited. It was, you know, it was one of these like, boy, this would be super cool to be a part of history, but I don't know that I can go down and be a part of the George W. Bush recount team in Florida. And ultimately I told Bobby, like, I'm sorry, man. Like, you're going to have to go down there and do this without me, because I'm going to be home, you know, cheering on the other side. And I continue to do, you know, lots of other work for Bobby. You know, but I turned that down. So put all of that together. If somebody heard me say that I want, you know, the position of opening arguments is check your personal ethics at the door when you become a lawyer, that in no way was what I meant to say. And I don't think a lot of people interpret it that way. But if somebody did, it's why I thought this was worth addressing. One more thing. A lot of our law student listeners, just when this episode drops, we'll have just completed taking the bar. So good luck to all of you guys. And hopefully TTTB helped.
May you do as well as Thomas or better.
There you go. That is heartfelt from all of us at Opening Arguments to you. Good luck.
All right. This is, you know, again, Andrew is the best. It's not quite baseball law level. trying to, I don't know what the term is, foreplay or something for what we need to get to. But, you know, important listener question. And now we need to get the hell to Yodel Mountain because that's where everybody wants to be. But no, thank you for the question and good clarification there.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay, here we are. We've set up a camp somewhere on Yodel Mountain, and we're gonna have to do a lot of walking because we're climbing. I think we're climbing Yodel Mountain right now. We are climbing and climbing. Andrew, huge news week yodel wise. What do we want to start with? We got Cohen's tapes that were leaked. Do you want to start with that?
Yeah. So let's talk about that because there are some interesting legal questions around that, right? So first, we have talked about whether states are one party or two party consent states in the past. New York is a one party consent state. And that's a really interesting euphemism, right? Because one party consent means not consent, right? Like that means the person who's recording it has consented.
It would mean that you can't go plant a recording device somewhere and capture two other people's conversations, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You the get smart theory of recording does not. Right. But so here's how these calls were recorded. They were recorded at Trump's office in Trump Tower. And again, this is coming from Rudy Giuliani. So, you know, that's all we have to go by. But what Rudy Giuliani says is that Michael Cohen secretly recorded the conversations while in Donald Trump's office. And Michael Cohen hasn't disputed this. That's not a crime. That's not, you know, it's not illegal in any way because New York is a one-party consent state. And then Giuliani and the Trump team decided that they were not going to assert attorney-client
privilege.
Yeah, okay,
that's what I was going to ask you about because I don't think we had that information a while ago, but now I'm seeing they just waived any sort of I don't know what the term would be, but it seemed as though they like signed off on it. Like the lawyers were not going to fight it. Kind of. And then, but also simultaneously, the claim is that it's illegal and it violates attorney. You know, like it seems like they're claiming something publicly, but then privately or I guess legally speaking, they're not doing anything. So what do you think of that? How do you explain that?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, with respect to the inconsistency, we have seen time and time again, this administration, you know, issue a press release. Think about the Sanctuary Cities executive order that we covered, right? You know, they issued a press release saying this is going to end, you know, sanctuary cities in the United States. And then when called in to defend it, before the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California, they said, oh, well, you know, the executive order does nothing, right? Like it does. it does not change policy in any way. Right. So you are absolutely correct. The legal position the Trump administration has taken in court is we are not asserting that these are covered by attorney-client privilege. But nevertheless, they've sent out their surrogates, you know, Ann Coulter, to say this is the worst violation of attorney-client privilege. It's dead in this country, you know, all of that. Shouldn't be surprising, right? And again, let's have a modicum of bipartisanship.
Let's clarify before you get some emails about Andrew was wrong. Ann Coulter, I think she was fed up with Trump for not being racist enough. So I know that she had a big, I'm not even joking, she had a big break with Trump over not delivering the wall. I don't even know if she's a surrogate, but I can't get a proper read on, you know, because she was like anti-Trump because of that. And then, so I'm not sure she's a surrogate, but yeah, they are essentially saying like, oh, this is outrageous, this is illegal. And then do you think that the not fighting this is just because they realize the reality of it? Like there's just nothing they can do, or is there a strategy? What do you think?
So I've been puzzling over this one for a while because we're going to talk about the substance of the one tape that of which we have heard part of so far. And the only thing that I can come up with from a strategic vantage point is the privilege between an attorney and a client rests exclusively with the client, right? If the client directs the lawyer to release privileged communications, the lawyer has to do that. Right, the lawyer doesn't have an independent interest in doing so. So it is at the absolute discretion of Donald Trump. And we have talked at great length, you can go back through the archives, about what constitutes attorney-client privilege and what doesn't, right? The crime fraud exception, when you call up your lawyer and say, hey, Andrew, what's the best way to knock off a 7-Eleven, right? If I give you advice, and I will not give you advice, but if I were to give you advice there, that right, that's not attorney-client privilege. I'm assisting you in the planning and or commission of a crime, and neither of us get to keep that confidential.
Right.
Similarly, less in a manner that is less evil and malicious, when attorneys perform non-legal work, right? When I perform business work for someone, that is not protected by attorney-client privilege, right? So if I am negotiating a lower price on a contract and there's no legal advice involved, then our conversations regarding that are not attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, or if you're just a courier for briefcases full of cash to porn stars,
right.
That's also
yes,
not
exactly
illegal.
Right.
Unless we're going to get to that unit of the bar exam, I don't think.
Of the bar, you must listen to the end of today's episode for TTTV.
Everyone dreads real property, but they love porn star cash delivery. That's the good section of the bar.
That is the good stuff. So here's what I would analogize it to. Sometimes you have to make your case with a witness over which there are bad facts, right? And again, I imagine this happens more frequently for criminal defense attorneys, but it happens to me in civil trials all the time, right? Like the last time this came up, I had a client who left his former employment to set up his own company and was accused wrongly, in my opinion, of having stolen company secrets, right? And this was a tort, right? This was a civil lawsuit, not a criminal matter. On his way out, my client said and did some things that looked bad, right? Because they had he was a trusted employee.
This is a take this job and shove it kind of situation.
Exactly right. And so one of the things that lawyers will do when you have bad facts is there are two different techniques that you might use with respect to bad facts. And I've used both of these at trial before. So number one is you might introduce that fact on direct examination, right?
Try to get out in front
of it. In fact, that was what I did. Exactly. You say, you know, and so I said, you know, now, Mr. X, that there came a time when, you know, you and, you know, the plaintiff reached a stage where you weren't getting along. Is that fair to say? And then, you know, we talked about how to prep this. And he would laugh and say, yeah, that would be an understatement. Right. And then I said, yeah. And so, you know, how would you characterize the state of that relationship? And he said, well, you know, it got heated. I was mad. I did this. And then I, you know, and then I introduced the document that was bad. And I said, and in fact, on your way out, you sent this email, right? Right. And this is pretty strongly, right. You know, so we went through that and got out in front of it, right? And it was fine. The other thing you might do, and this happens a lot when you have a witness who has a prior marginally related criminal conviction, right? If it's an unrelated criminal conviction, we've talked about this on TTTBE. We're actually going to talk about this later on in this segment. An unrelated criminal conviction is very likely excludable under Rule 403 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, right? Its prejudicial value is going to outweigh its probative value. The question happens, what happens when you have it in the middle, right? And do you want to have this debate over your client's prior criminal history take place potentially, you know, in front of a jury? Instead, you might say, particularly if the judge is leaning that way and says, you know, I'm inclined to allow questions on the, what you might say is, okay, then what we're going to do is we're going to stipulate as a matter of public record that my client was convicted of X crime, right? And so you stipulate for the record, and then that cuts off, right? They don't have to introduce that as testimony anymore, and they're prevented from getting up and doing the, like, Your Honor, the lawyer from the Simpsons, I had no idea that this witness was...
we got a criminal in the witness box.
Right. How could we possibly... Right. So
bailiff, arrest this man. No. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So... So I apply that analogy, and I would say, if Donald Trump and his legal team thinks fighting about the content of these tapes is going to look worse than relinquishing his privilege, then, you know, that's the only way that I can come up with that it makes sense. And so, you know, now
clear. Even if they went out guns a-blazing and they had a team of Andrews fighting for this, it doesn't seem like they could stop it, right? Because very clearly this is not protected under privilege, or is there any other way that they could suppress it? So it would be a lost cause to fight it, right? Or do you think there's some chance they could succeed somehow?
Yeah, I mean, again, we don't know what's on these 12 tapes, but... If it is what has been characterized, then
well, we know
yeah,
it's on
it would be a,
some of it. Some of it's come out. Right?
We know what's on one of them. Yes. And or part of one, I should say. And that's a pretty good transition. Right. Yeah, but yes, if they were to fight it, then there would be a public hearing over the contents of the tapes. And Donald Trump and his legal team, again, in my view, must have concluded that they are better off not having that argument.
I see. So,
and just dealing piecemeal with what comes
out. So you're saying because we don't know what's on the rest of the tapes, you can't answer for certain that they couldn't stop it. But given the indication of the one tape we know, in all likelihood, they couldn't stop it.
Yeah, okay. That's exactly right. And so what we do know, that the audio that we do have right now relates to Karen McDougal. And we talked about her. She's the former Playboy Playmate whose story was purchased and then buried by the National Enquirer, right? And we talked about her in OA 158. And my analysis at the time was, this is not a Yodel Mountain story. It's not the same as Stormy Daniels, because the difference between Donald Trump directing that the story be silenced, which is what happened with Stormy Daniels, which is the violation of election law, and the National Enquirer directing that it be silenced is the difference between violating the election laws and not. I would say what we have right now is not conclusive, right? It does not show beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump was involved in squelching the story and violating election laws, but it strongly is probative in that direction. And from a tactical perspective, right, Michael Cohen is now represented by Lanny Davis, an unbelievably smart lawyer and somebody who is a lifelong Clintonite, right? No fan of Donald Trump. I think if you want a prediction from me, if you're looking at the tea leaves, I think we are very, very close to Michael Cohen flipping on Donald Trump. That's where I think we're headed. And I base that on the totality of the circumstances, right? The way in which this first tape was leaked and the response from the Trump legal team, which is not conciliatory, which is not, you know, suggesting a back channel pardon, all of that, which is combative. And in my view, right, that is a little bit of a dance. You know, if I were Lanny Davis, I would be meeting with Michael Cohen saying, I know you've been loyal to this guy your entire life, but we put out the trial balloon and you saw what they did. And if you want me to keep you out of jail, here's the best way for me to keep you from going to prison.
Sorry, can you clarify, what do you mean when you say we put out the trial balloon and you saw, what did you mean by that? Maybe I didn't follow.
So Lanny Davis, right, they released the first, an excerpt from the first tape. Right. And I can't prove that this is the reason why they did that. Right. That's the stuff, the McDougal stuff. Right. So that's out there. And the response back to that release was highly combative from Trump's legal team. Again, I can't prove that this is what Lanny Davis is doing. I am not a criminal defense attorney. All I'm saying is that if I were assisting in Michael Cohen's defense, I would be taking that response back to Michael Cohen saying, here's where we are. And if you're asking me for my advice for how to best keep you out of prison, my advice to how to best keep you out of prison would be, it's time to roll over on Donald Trump. That would be my advice.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. So the rest of the tape stuff, right? Like I'm kind of reluctant to go into what else it could mean because we just don't know, right? We haven't seen it.
Couldn't we hear him say like, you know, get something like go get a duffel bag full of cash? Whoa, is that all related to the McDougal stuff? Or we just can't tell yet?
Yeah, we can't. We cannot tell, right? I presume that, right? You generally don't start off with the most smoking gun in these sorts of circumstances, right? Mm. So again, I would presume that what's out there is much worse than what we've heard. Again, that's assuming, right? So I'm making a lot of assumptions in the background here, right? I am assuming that Michael Cohen has said to Lanny Davis, I'm going to continue to hold out and fight. I don't know how bad it is. And, you know, I've been the fixer for the president of the United States. And once this all goes away, he's going to take care of me and I'll be okay. And if that is the message that Michael Cohen has sent to Lanny Davis, then Lanny Davis is probably having, you know, several come to Jesus moments with his client right now in which he's saying, yeah, you're holding out for a pardon. You may be holding out for a long, long time and you may never get there. So that's my take on the situation. Again, there's an awful lot out there that is speculative that we don't know, but I'm happy to make that prediction, and I will be very unhappy to do an Andrew was wrong if Michael Cohen does not
flip. Right. So that's where we are with the tapes. That there's no other implications as of now. We're just kind of speculating. And
yeah, we just, I, you know, that's, you heard, I'm already uncomfortable with speculation on speculation, but, that's where I'm willing to go. That's how the tapes got out there. That's why they're not privileged. And we're just going to have to wait for more audio.
I guess I want to ask the basic question. I don't know if we've addressed the very basic question of doesn't this, we all already knew. That's why we haven't answered the basic question. Cause all of us listening on talking and anything here, we all know that Donald Trump was lying about Stormy Daniels from the beginning. But does this change anything? Because now we really, really, really know that he was lying about Stormy Daniels from the beginning. And
Yeah. I think that it is time to kind of circle back and point out the fundamental. I mean, I think you're exactly right. That remember the story in public that Donald Trump, that through his legal team, that Rudy Giuliani maintains today is, the Stormy Daniels story was false, and the payoff was to stop her from lying, and that's why there was an NDA. Now, we have exposed that as not plausible since the first week of March, right? Since our Stormy Daniels is a Legal Genius episode. The reason that it is a settlement agreement and not just a baseline NDA is because Donald Trump is compromising the claims that he has against Stormy Daniels. And the only way for him to have claims and for him to be the person who can enforce that agreement is if he has live claims against her. And if it's an entirely made up allegation, then there's nothing for her to give up in return, right? And it specifies, right. You know, tapes and text messages and all sorts of things, right? It's time to return to that because there is kind of a morphing in the right-wing defense sphere of, you know, well, now we're in Clinton territory and I didn't care about Bill Clinton and, you know, you shouldn't care about what Donald Trump does with a porn star before the election, blah, 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 blah. And I think it's critical to kind of pin those folks down and go, okay, so are you conceding that Donald Trump is lying right now when he says the equivalent of, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, you know, Ms. Daniels? And I think, again, as with everything, as with every step on Yodel Mountain, right? It's about documenting. It's about being 100% accurate. It's about proving this beyond a reasonable doubt. And again, not because that's the legal standard, but because that's the political standard. That's the standard for swinging that swath of middle America that, you know, is not, right? I mean, people who listen to this show have been asking us, how do we impeach Donald Trump since January of 2017, right? That's not the question. The question is, how do we bring along folks who weren't there, who ought to be there, right? Who look at it and say, yes, Nixon should have left office in disgrace and he should have been impeached and removed if he refused to resign. And if that's your standard, how do we prove to those people that this is worse than Watergate, as we to use the phrase that Thomas Smith has coined? And I think you're exactly right.
Hey guys, today's episode is brought to you by Filter Easy. This I love when we get sponsors like this. You see a theme that all of us are super busy and always forget to do routine household tasks. One of the things I never remember to do on time is change my air conditioning air filters. Here's how Filter Easy works. You sign up, you tell them how many air filters you need, and the size, right? You can read that just on the side of it. And they send you the appropriate filters at the appropriate time. The big box arrives on your doorstep and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I had to go change my filter. Look, if you're like me and you're always late in changing your air filters, you should know, particularly in the summer, that that's when you risk poor indoor air quality. It exacerbates your allergies. In fact, the EPA ranks poor indoor air quality as one of their top five environmental health risks. It's exacerbated if you're like Thomas or I and you have pets and there's pet hair circulating through your AC. You want to be reminded to change your air filters. This is a great service. I use Filter Easy. And one of the cool things is, right, it's a subscription service for something you have to do. You have to change your air filters. It's super practical. It's a no-brainer solution. And here's our call to action. Listeners of the program can receive your first order free by going to filtereasy.com or by dialing 1-855-910-EASY. That's 1-855-910-3279. And use the promo code arguments. So sign up today, filtereasy.com. Get your first order for free. That's filtereasy.com or 1-855-910-EASY. Use the offer code arguments. Give them a try.
Well, but there's good news, right? Because Republicans are drawing up articles of impeachment right now against Rod Rosenstein. Oh, sorry. I should have read the full headline there. Yeah, no, okay. That's the response.
Yeah.
Again, imagine if in, the 70s, when Watergate was happening and all that, Republicans in Congress drew up articles of impeachment for, I can't remember the guy's name, the special prosecutor.
Archibald Cox.
Yeah, exactly. Like, imagine if that was the response. Like, that's why in many ways this is worse than Watergate, but also the Republican complicity is worse than Watergate. Were you going to cover the Rod Rosenstein stuff?
I'm going to say one sentence on that, although it may have several semicolons because it's an Andrew sentence. we retweeted out Congressman Ted Lieu, who said, I think all that needs to be said on the House articles of impeachment against Rod Rosenstein, which is it had 11 co-sponsors from the farthest yapping right wing of the House Freedom Caucus. It will not get a vote. It is not going to come up. It does not reflect where the majority of House Republicans are. These are, you know, the furthest right of the right. And, you know, if Congressman Liu and I are too optimistic on that, well, you know, we'll cover that going forward. But right now, I think this is, you know, the equivalent of, you know, it's throwing red meat to a base, you know, in an election year. And that's all I interpret that as.
Yeah. All right. I hear you. I have this desire to go on a rant about how these people do exist and they're elected and there's no equivalent to this on the left. As much as people try to make Ocasio-Cortez out to be like this equivalent on the left, but I won't do any of that. I won't even mention it. Oh wait, I mentioned it. What do we?
Thank
gotta,
you
let's
for
talk
not
about
mentioning.
You're welcome. Let's talk about this emoluments lawsuit.
Yeah, this is super interesting. We last covered the status of the emoluments lawsuit in episodes 160 and 162. These are the lawsuits being brought by, among others, the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia, and also some individual plaintiffs. In 160, we talked about the court's ruling on standing, and our buddy Seth Barrett-Tillman, who wrote a very influential amicus brief in this lawsuit, wrote in to point out that there were additional arguments on the motion to dismiss that were scheduled for oral argument in July. And so there was an additional path to this lawsuit being thrown out. I am now happy to report that the court has, with one exception, which has to do with the individual plaintiff, so it's not at all relevant to what we've discussed, the court has now resolved all of those issues. And the court's ruling is that the motions to dismiss with respect to the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia are denied, and that the allegations contained in the complaint, and these are allegations on the order of Donald Trump and his administration sending foreign officials, you know, directing that foreign officials stay on Trump properties, all of those sorts of ancillary benefits by which Donald Trump is getting rich at the expense of the public treasury, that states a prima facie violation of both the foreign and the domestic emoluments clauses. Here's the significance of that. I'm going to read, you know, you read a district court's opinion, you scroll to the bottom and you figure out what it directs people to do. And here is the court's order. The court directs the parties to promptly consult and within 21 days submit a joint recommendation suggesting the next steps to be taken in the case, including whether any further amendment of the amended complaint is necessary, what time for the president to file an answer herein should be, what the general outline of any proposed discovery should be, and any other matter the parties deem appropriate to bring to the attention of the court. That is a scheduling directive, and what that means is Donald Trump is going to have to answer the complaint. Now, he's going to answer that with general denials. That's not a big deal. And then when he denies the factual predicate in these complaints, the attorney generals of Maryland and the District of Columbia, including my buddy Brian Frosch, are going to be able to seek discovery from Donald Trump, the Trump organization, related to these emoluments clause arguments. There is, because this is the denial of a motion to dismiss, you don't get to appeal that right now, right? So there is no appeal. This is a lawsuit that's going forward. There's going to be discovery.
Wow.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. Now, look, what certainly could happen, and what I think is very likely to happen is, I think that you will have, here's the way this is going to play out.
At some point, it jumps up to the Supreme Court, which Trump is stacked with originalists, and they say, no, it's fine, and then everything goes away. Is that how? That's just Thomas prediction.
Here's how it's going to play out. The plaintiffs in this case are going to request information. The defendants, right? Donald Trump, the Trump Organization, are going to object to the production of that information. The court is going to rule that they are required to turn that over. And Donald Trump is going to refuse to turn that over, which is then going to bring a separate collateral lawsuit to get a writ of mandamus to require Donald Trump to turn that over. And that will indeed, that is going to track the Nixon litigation that required him to release the tapes. Yep. And that's what it's going to be about. And ultimately, you know, it's going to have to go up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, do we have a court that is more conservative than Bush v. Gore. So, you know, do we have a political Supreme Court? We do. Do I think that the Supreme Court may try and distinguish the Nixon precedent, which, remember, that occurred in the context of a criminal investigation? You also have the Clinton v. Jones precedent, which was a civil lawsuit brought against Bill Clinton during his time in office. Yeah, this is a...
Okay.
Let me stop. This is a civil and administrative lawsuit, right? This is for violations of the Emoluments Clause. This is not to impeach or arrest the president, right? So it is not a criminal investigation in that sense. It is administrative, and the private plaintiffs in particular, and their case is still pending. We talked about that, are asserting that they have suffered pecuniary
damages
harm, right?
Because they're losing out on business because of this unfair advantage.
Right. Because okay. I have so a hotel.
I was going to jump to what I was going to ask, which is what's best case scenario for anti-Trump people in this case is just, oh, you are violating this and pay people money or what? Like, what's best case scenario?
Yeah. Well, and then you will have a determination by a court of competent jurisdiction. So two things, right? Number one, there is the payment of money. Number two, there is the issuance of an injunction, right? The lawsuit requests injunctive relief blocking the president from continuing to violate the emoluments clauses. And then number three, you would have an adjudication by a court of competent jurisdiction that the president has violated the emoluments clause
and the Constitution. And this all amounts to, as you've said, for gosh, I guess we're going on a year and a half of this. The only thing that counts as high crimes and misdemeanors and would actually lead to impeachment is whatever the Republican Congress decides is high crimes and misdemeanors. So even if we get certified by a judge that he's violating the Constitution over and over, it doesn't matter until Congress does anything about it. Just to jump ahead to the, does this mean we get to have the Scooby-Doo style ending where we, you know, he says, I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for opening arguments. And that's not how it works.
That's not how it works, but I feel like we're doing our part. And there is, I continue to have optimism that there are bridges that a significant chunk of Republicans will not cross. And I continue to have that optimism. I do want to kind of circle back on the law geekery because I can't help it. So this opinion directly opines that the term emolument, as used in both the foreign and domestic emoluments clauses, has an expansive meaning, right? And that, quote, the framers were acutely aware of and concerned about the potential for foreign or domestic influence of any sort over the president. An emolument within the meaning of the emoluments clauses was intended to reach beyond simple payment for services rendered, and was intended to embrace and ban anything more than de minimis profit, gain, or advantage offered to a public official in his private capacity, wholly apart from his official salary. So that is the court taking a broad view of emoluments. And for long-term OA listeners, the fun deep dive. Yeah, we had Seth Barrett Tillman on in episodes 35 and 36. He had a really interesting idiosyncratic argument that says the Foreign Emoluments Clause doesn't apply to the president at all, right? Because the presidency is not an office of trust or profit under the United States, under the meaning of the Constitution. I have to say this, the Section 3 of this opinion is designed and addresses Professor Tillman's amicus brief asserting this argument. He got 5 full pages of a district court opinion addressing his amicus brief.
Wow.
It rejected his argument.
Congrats, Seth.
Absolutely. Yeah. He influenced the debate and discussion, and I'm sure his efforts to do so are not over. I'm reaching out to Professor Tillman, and we might I'd love to have him back on the show again and chat about everything. That's a cool accomplishment, right? It is to write an amicus brief and have this. No, we will, but to have the court say this is an interesting argument. It is raised, well argued, substantively briefed, and here's why we reject it. So I encourage you. We don't have time to get into it. Doesn't have any Yodel Mountain implications. I'm going to link the opinion in the show notes, and I would encourage everyone to go read it. And we're going to talk to Professor Tillman and see if it makes sense to bring him back on to chat about kind of what's next for that argument. Good on you, right?
Yeah,
it's an impressive thing.
All right. Well, interesting. I heard about that emoluments news. It seems positive to at least bring this to light. But as always, it's not going to be that silver bullet thing. But nonetheless, it's good to know that maybe the system will try to cope with the fact that Trump is violating the Constitution constantly. Last Yodel Mountain thing, Manafort update. Now, there was a bit of Andrew was possibly wrong on this, right? Didn't you predict something that didn't happen? Or am I? I'm not trying to rub it in.
Yeah.
I just,
rub it in. It's all good. Here's how
we
I was
get
wrong.
Emails. We get emails. I saw.
I confidently predicted on Tuesday's episode, recorded a week ago today, that the trial was going to start Wednesday and that Judge Ellis, no-nonsense guy I said I like, was not going to grant any continuance, was not going to further delay the trial. I was wrong. He delayed the trial by 3 business days. to Tuesday, July 31st. So, I was indeed wrong about that. I want to add parenthetically, and again, because I don't like being wrong, that Manafort's lawyers asked for months. The oral argument, the transcript of that argument is still under seal. So I tried to download it from Pacer today, and I can't download it because it contains the information that the government requested to be redacted. And there's some, potential issues about what's going to be disclosed to the public. So I don't know the rationale. The written order doesn't explain why Judge Ellis granted a 3-day extension of time. I do want to flag from a legal strategy perspective, again, as somebody who was partners in a law firm that did a lot of white collar criminal defense, Paul Manafort is in prison right now. You typically don't ask for month long delays in your trial if you think your guy is innocent. Yeah, if you think your guy is going to get released,
guy's been sitting in jail. He's totally innocent. Can we delay this trial for 10 years though? Can we just? Maybe 10 years from now.
now you do get credit for time served, right? So, but what this strongly suggests is Manafort's lawyers know, and Paul Manafort himself knows, he is not getting out of this either via plea or via adjudication without having to serve time in prison. So keep that one in mind. The second thing that you need to know is after this 3-day extension, part of this has to do with the parties going back and forth over jury selection. And it's not worth getting into the minutia over that, but jury selection is underway. And so this trial is going to start on Tuesday, July 31st, before our next episode drops. Unless Manafort pleads out, I'm going to upload the latest document, which is the wrangling over jury selection. If you like looking at those things, I paid to download it from Pacer. So you guys might as well get the benefit of looking at it. There were also some additional issues that were outstanding as of our last recording, right? There were some motions in limine. There was the government's motion for immunity and to seal the names of the witnesses. So Judge Ellis has ruled on those. Judge Ellis ruled that the witnesses were to be immunized, can be compelled to testify, but consistent with his approach throughout this trial, which has really been with an eye towards sunshine, right, with an eye towards drawing attention on the larger context, he denied the government's motion to seal who those witnesses are. So those five witnesses are Dennis Rako, Cindy Laporta, Connor O'Brien, Donna Duggan, and James Brennan.
Yeah, if you folks are listening, you're witnesses, so get over that. Is that the point of this, like a roll call? The following listeners, please check in.
I am trying to figure out who these people are. I can't tell you. I know who any of them are at this point. I have figured some fun stuff out from something that I'm about to get to in a minute. But I like putting this out there because we have journalists, we have lawyers who listen to the show, and if they remember certain connections, you know, share it with us, tweet it at us, email us. We're gonna try and get to the bottom of this, of who these witnesses were who had no interest in flipping on Paul Manafort until they were immunized. With respect to the motions in limine, this is an Andrew was right. Judge Ellis ruled, took the government's position on all of those motions in limine, with one exception, and this is something that wasn't fully briefed by the time we went to press last week, and that is that Paul Manafort has asked the court to prevent the government from introducing testimony regarding his relationship with Viktor Yanukovych, the former president of Ukraine. Yanukovych is the candidate of the Party of Regions. That was the pro-Russia party. He was elected president of Ukraine in 2010. He then fled the country. He is now in exile in Russia. He is wanted in Ukraine for treason. And I want you to put a pin in Viktor Yanukovych because this is going to come back up. But the rest of the motions in limine, as I said, were resolved in the government's favor. And in particular, remember that the government objected to a blanket instruction from Paul Manafort that they didn't want anything between Manafort and the Trump campaign. And the government said, yeah, we want to specifically introduce testimony regarding Manafort's relationship with Lender D, who intervened to approve a government loan to Paul Manafort under the promise that that person would receive an appointment or something else from Donald Trump, right? That's the way it was listed in the motion in limine. Based on the fact that the government has now uploaded its exhibit list, I think I know who Lender D is, and I've done some digging. His name is Stephen Calk, C-A-L-K. He is a banker in Chicago, and in February, Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland sent a letter to Secretary of Defense Mattis requesting information as part of House oversight about what he called extremely troubling reports that a banker named Stephen Calk may have made loans of up to $16 million to President Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, in exchange for alleged promises to name him Secretary of the Army. obviously, that request for information went nowhere. Democrats can still retake the House in midterm elections. It went nowhere to date, but that's how you connect that back up. And that information will be introduced at Paul Manafort's trial, that Paul Manafort used his role as Donald Trump's campaign manager to get shady approval for a $16 million loan by promising that Donald Trump was going to name this guy Secretary of the Army. So the Yanukovych stuff is still pending. because the government hates us, the government's response, the court has ordered that the government's response is due today at 5 p.m. And that, I'm sorry, the court has ordered that Manafort's response is due today at 5 p.m. and that the government's answer to that is due tomorrow at 5 p.m. So, you know, we're going to have to wait, but we will find out whether the government is going to be able to talk about Manafort's relationship with the pro-Russian exiled president of Ukraine. We'll know that by the time Manafort's trial begins. What we do know now also stems, I alluded to this earlier, from the exhibit list. I'm going to link this in the show notes. But one of the things that happens before you go to trial, right? We've made fun of in Lawed Awful Movies, the, you know, I have a string of surprising witnesses, each more surprising than the last, right? Like you, what you actually do in a trial is before it begins, you introduce an exchange, you give to the judge and to the other side, your list of those exhibits, right? So when you're watching a trial and they say, you know, this is defense 36, keep in mind that, you know, the prosecution had defense 36 before the trial began, right? Mm-hmm. That's a little tip. So there are 436 items listed on the government's exhibit list. And so what these are is their description of what the documents are. It's a one-line description. So for emails, it says who wrote it, who'd they write it to, what's the subject line, what's the date, right? This is how I figured out Calk is Banker D. And this is where the potential bombshell lies. And I want to flag this for our listeners right now, because when this blows up, this is the line of argumentation that Republicans are going to use to try and muddy the waters. So I want to walk through it really, really carefully right now. I think this is really, really significant. I haven't seen anybody else talking about this. On the exhibit list are 16 pieces of correspondence between the Manafort Organization and Tad Devine. And Tad Devine is a long-standing Democratic Party operative. He worked for Michael Dukakis. He worked for Al Gore. He worked for John Kerry. And he was the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders. Tad Devine also does international media consulting. I want to say this as clearly as possible. There are only two possibilities to explain the Tad Devine Paul Manafort connection, which again, we're going to talk about the specific documents in a second. The first is that he's an amoral scumbag who is for sale to the highest bidder. That's the best case scenario. Okay.
Oh, wow. That's the best case scenario?
Yeah. Oof. Yes. You are rooting for scumbag. Okay. The worst case scenario is that he is a part, either as part of the planning process or unwittingly, of the Russian efforts to intervene in the 2016 presidential election. I want to be very, very clear that we do not have enough evidence to support that second conclusion yet, but we do have enough evidence to support at least the scumbag conclusion. So here's what we have. Here's what the exhibit list shows. Between 2010 and 2014, there was extensive contact between Tad Devine and Paul Manafort, lifelong Republican operative criminal Paul Manafort. There are emails back and forth from Devine to Manafort, from Devine to Rick Gates, and most troubling, between Devine and Russian intelligence operative Konstantin Kalimnik, right? The person who was person A in the Manafort indictments, and somebody who is an active Russian intelligence asset. The first email begins with a subject line that says 2-3-2010 election night speech. And then the second email says 2-15-2010 job well done. Okay, so we're talking about an election. And you might be thinking, boy, February of 2010 is kind of a weird time to be talking about an election. And the reason is because, right, that's too early for U.S. primaries. There were no special elections that I could find, certainly no special elections for which Tad Devine was working for a candidate. We're 8 months before the general election, right? Like, what is this talking about? This refers to the February 2010 Ukrainian presidential election.
Oh, wow.
In which Tad Devine worked for the Party of Regions, in which he did international media consulting work for Yanukovych, the pro-Russian president elected under the Party of Regions banner, and collaborated with Paul Manafort to get Yanukovych elected. Yanukovych, again, is a believed to be, well, let me not characterize. I will tell you again, Yanukovych fled Ukraine and is wanted for high treason in that country. And there are reports that are unverified that he has been offered private in a private communication that he has been offered citizenship directly by Vladimir Putin. So take that however you will. The kindest interpretation is Tad Devine, Democratic Party operative, is also an amoral scumbag and doesn't mind electing a pro-Russian president of Ukraine so long as they pay the bills.
Wow.
That is the best possible interpretation. It certainly is troublesome, right? We talked about this in OA 106, in which we went into the, quote, Bernie Sanders lawsuit against the DNC. And we discovered in breaking down that lawsuit that the lawyers involved were right-wing Republican Party operatives, and that at oral argument, they explicitly relied 100% for their allegations on Guccifer 2.0, the Russian intelligence operative responsible for leaking the hacked DNC documents. At the time, the way I characterized that was, this is a right-wing lawsuit that is slapping Bernie Sanders' name on it in order to masquerade as something other than what it is. And certainly there are, you know, troubling indications from that connection. Seeing Bernie Sanders' campaign manager involved in a blatantly pro-Russia scheme with the person who would become Donald Trump's campaign manager. I we don't have evidence on it, but if that doesn't trouble you, I don't know what will. It troubles me.
What do you think the implications on Bernie Sanders are, though? Because you know, as much as I'm pro-Hillary, I think a lot of people are taking this news and trying to make it like Sanders was in on some Russian thing to steal the election from Hillary. And that doesn't seem right to me. But what are your thoughts? I mean, does chief strategist for his campaign, you know, so that's pretty involved.
Yep. And let's be clear again, because it is not relevant to the Manafort prosecution, there are no post-2014 communications that are listed on the government's exhibit list, right? So there are two ways to interpret that, right? The first is there was no further communication between Tad Devine and Paul Manafort. If that's the case, then he's just an amoral scumbag who got a pro-Russian stooge elected in Ukraine. Again, best case scenario. The fact that those documents are not listed does not mean that there was no further communication. And if that's the case, if you have somebody who is in on what we described in our last Friday episode, right? We described the extent of the latest Mueller indictments and how deep and how long the Russian efforts to interfere with U.S. elections going back to 2011, right? Building contacts through Butina with the NRA, that should be a lot more troubling, right? And so from there, right, you can infer a lot of different approaches, right? And again, the one that's most friendly to Bernie Sanders that is certainly a live possibility is the Republicans wanted to take advantage of the division in the Democratic Party between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, right? That is certainly a possible outcome. Right. But you have to, and they may have, you know, done no back channeling and no, you know, and it may all just be a really happy coincidence. We don't know. Again.
Yeah, I just think that the Bernie's behavior and his platform and his message has been so consistent throughout his political career that it just, I that's why I just reject any idea. I mean, I'm open to evidence, obviously.
But right. So the idea that he's in on some plot,
it just doesn't seem right to
me. No. Let's be very, very clear with that, right? Like, I think it goes to the fringes of Alex Jones territory to do that, right? Like, I've seen, you know, I mean, Bernie Sanders spent, I think, his 1975 honeymoon in the Soviet Union, right? Like, that's weird. It's a weird fact, and I think it would have been disastrous had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic nominee. You know, that certainly would have come up. But let's be clear, right? I don't think this does not provide any evidence that Bernie Sanders is a Russian intelligence asset, right? It does not even prove that Bernie Sanders is, you know, I don't know the Russian word for useful idiot, right? Like, it doesn't even show that. But it certainly, within the realm of possibility, is separating out the Bernie Sanders campaign and message, right? Which is, as you and I agree, like a perfectly reasonable grounds upon which to conduct a Democratic Party primary and to debate back and forth and to talk about those issues from, hey, you know, is it useful to, right? Like if there were back channels to the Sanders campaign that said, hey, is it useful to us to have, you know, X or Y or Z come out? You know, we know, right? This is from our intelligence agencies that the Russian intelligence operatives and the Kremlin made a political decision to attack Hillary Clinton beginning in the primaries, right? That was the one candidate that they did not want to win the presidency. So, you know, I would certainly want to know what the connections are, if any, between anybody connected with Russia and the Sanders campaign, right? And again, right now, we don't have any evidence of that, but I certainly find it troubling, right? Like, I watched an awful lot of MSNBC in the Democratic primaries. I watched an awful lot of Tad Devine on MSNBC criticizing Donald Trump. And I don't ever recall Tad Devine saying, oh, by the way, like, I used to work really closely with Donald Trump's current campaign manager, right? Like, that at minimum, failure to disclose that is a real problem. And it's something, again, I'm not saying this as a Hillary supporter. I'm saying this because and this is sort of where I get to is the bottom line. If the investigations continue to show what we believe that there's strong evidence that they show to date, right? This level of efforts by the Russians to infiltrate the American political system and corrupt our democracy, the next line of defense will be the, well, you know, both parties do this too, right? Will be, right, oh yeah, no, that this is all bad, and anybody who had any effort, right, then, you know, we need to root that out, and, you know, yes, some Republicans did it, but so do Democrats, and here it is, right? And I just want us to be prepared that that's the next retreatment point. And in order to engage with that, in order to understand and be able to fully draw our distinction, we need to know what's going on with Tad Devine here. So, like I said, let's root for amoral scumbag because what's next on the list is
three cheers for amoral scumbag.
Yeah.
All right. Well, whew, man, that is some percentage of Yodel Mountain. I think there's even more, but you know, we can only do what we can only do because this is such a ridiculous news week. But wow, I am stunned by how deep this goes and the fact that it's Bernie's campaign, not campaign manager, chief strategist. I mean, whew, this is just nuts. I mean, this is just bananas. I don't, how else can we react in this country right now? I don't even know. Hopefully, I guess we all just root for amoral scumbag. That's the message of today's show.
Yeah.
Let's hope
if we've titled the episode Three Cheers for Amoral Scumbag.
Oh, wow.
But look, like, so I, you know, maybe there's some bridge building possibility, right? Like, I mean, we've talked about how what you need on Yodel Mountain is you know, kind of at least bringing Republicans along to, can we agree it's a bad thing for Vladimir Putin to hijack our democracy? And, you know, maybe if this gets us a step closer to mutual agreement, then, you know, maybe we can find a positive, you know, silver
lining. Yeah, or just vote the bastards out. Vote the bastards out. It's coming up, guys. A few months here, and then we can at least take the House, and then we get to direct some of these inquiries the right way. So let's do it.
Exactly right.
Yep. All right. Well, that's Yodel Mountain. Whew. When are we going to just float off into space? I don't know, because we are high atop Yodel Mountain. But thanks for the breakdown, Andrew. That was a lot to tackle. And really, like, co-host shout out here. That's Andrew has to do a ton to research all this week in, week out, two shows a week. You know, so that just a little shout out. Good job.
Thanks, man.
Good news, everyone. Today you'll be delivering a crate of subpoenas to Sicily 8, the mob planet.
All right. And I guess we're going to go out with some good news. We're wildly over time already, but can you in like 1 minute give us the good news here?
Yeah, this comes from friend of the show, Andrew Seidel. This has to do with a Ninth Circuit opinion, FFRF versus Chino Valley Unified School District. I'm going to link the decision in the show notes. We may break it down in a future Tuesday deep dive episode, but this is a victory for our friends over at the FFRF in drawing a line between extending a Supreme Court case, which is called Town of Greece versus Galloway. We've talked about it in previous episodes, which says that it is okay for town board meetings to begin with invocations and prayer. That decision has been used by school boards to open with prayer ever since the opinion came down. And the distinction is school boards virtually always have student representatives. Many times they are conducted in front of other students. And so, you know, the difference between a bunch of adults praying in a closed session, we would probably come down a different way on the Town of Greece decision in the first place. But at any event, you know, there's a pretty clear line to be drawn between those types of meetings and meetings where kids are present. And all of a sudden, you know, you've got a 13-year-old sitting there and they're told that this is a part of what the school board does. The Ninth Circuit per curiam opinion unequivocally said, unlike a session of Congress or state legislature or a meeting of a town board, the Chino Valley board meetings function as extensions of the educational experience of the district's public schools, and prayer at school board meetings therefore cannot be understood as part of the historical tradition of legislative prayer like that identified in the Town of Greece decision. So, good news. Big victory for our friends over at the FFRF, and at least we're closing perhaps, with something.
Yeah,
that's,
good
positive.
News, good job, and perhaps coming to a deep dive episode near you in the future to hear more about that. Yeah, good stuff. So there you go, a little tiny bit of good news to go out on. But now we've got to go out on even better big good news here, because we've got to thank our top patrons. It's Hall of Famer Friday. These folks pledged at patreon.com/law. In the Hall of Fame patron level or above, and we want to give them a big, fantastic weekly shout out. And I can't wait for them to be at that patron only Q&A, that kind of stuff. So here we go. OA Facebook page makes me feel like I have friends. Thank you. Rob Schreck, thanks
too.
Very much, Rob. Yeah. Sakashite Fukusumi holds himself in contempt about twice a day. Oh, so good. Matthew Vernon, Mike the Intactivist. Let this radicalize you rather than lead you to despair. I agree with the message, and good luck. I'm trying. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Price more for less cheese because customization increases labor costs. Oh, I think that's a McDonald's reference, sort of. Just this guy, you know. Getting off podcast. Bring back the McDonald's big extra with cheese. I could go. We could do. Okay. Me and whoever this is, we're going to start a branch off McDonald's podcast. I grew up on McDonald's, so I could tell you about the Arch Deluxe. We got the Big and Tasty. I love all the previous failed sandwiches. You know, that's my favorite. Anonymous, wordorigins.org, your source for pre Ally McBeal words and phrases. Alexa, play Yodel Mountain by Carol. Carolina Cotton. I don't know who that is, but I love the rest of that. Getting gay married at the Lukumi Leather Bar. Oh, this segment is so good. Lugens Enright 2020, make America irate again. Hey, I would I would support that ticket for sure. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. This is the darkest timeline. Time to grow a goatee. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Join your labor union. Yodel Mountain POTUS pardon zipline ride coming soon. Enjoy a quarter pounder with cheese at McDonald's in Thule, Utah. C6 Sarah. Rhonda is sorry she made Thomas say feckless bleep. Hey, no problem. You know, patrons get whatever they want, but this is a clean show. The patrons, just so you know, patrons got a unbleeped version of that, but for the main show, we do have to honor our non-explicit tag, so we bleeped it, but that's okay. Reagan Klein, I misspoke. I meant to say best, not first patron. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. The Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, Magister Fine and the Crew. I don't know. That must be, maybe that's one of those philosophers in space crossovers. Hot spots on my dog. What?
That's much better than hot sports.
Either way, I don't get it, but okay. Camp Quest is hiring. More info at campquest.org. Nothing worse than a monster who thinks he's right with God. Legalize the purge. Who is this God person anyway? Bigglesby, Tangerine, Octopus, Margarine, see you in 2 months. God bless. That which was decided without stare decisis may be overturned without stare decisis. Oh, I like that. It's like a play on the, that with the, you know.
With that. Hitchens razor.
Yeah, there you go. I like it. It could be a Torres's razor. So if you,
there you go.
Yeah, okay, I like it. Or whoever this is. A string of unpronounceable characters and Malika Chandler. Thank you, folks, so much.
Yeah, and thank you to Saul, Kevin Graham, Keith Davies, Jeff Steele falls asleep to the dulcet tones of Thomas interrupting, Unashamed McDonald's Customers Unite. Yes. I just pretend Andrew is whispering sweet nothings into my ears. Yeah, Thomas, too. It's a big thing. Jim Grove, Cooking Heath with Ramen, Mabu Tiza Gassi. That's got to be something, but I don't get it.
Yeah, I get it.
Ian and Allie, Yusuke Urameshi, PivotalSolutionsConsulting.com. I'd be less likely to eat McDonald's if anything else was open at 3 a.m. Taco Bell is definitely open at 3 a.m.
Okay.
It's
we
so
can
much
also
worse.
Unite oh, in man. Love of Taco Bell, right? So is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Taco Bell
fantastic
is
fantastic cuisine, authentic Mexican yeah. cuisine.
it's the worst, but sometimes you just
oh,
need
so
the worst.
Good. Oh, it's so good.
The phrase Windows 95 makes me laugh out loud. Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Humperdink, very nice. Connor Curtis, I misspoke. I meant to say criminalize the purge. Viva la cheeseless burger. Viva la revolucion. Soggy Pants, Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison. Putin good, fake news bad, Russia good, goo goo gaga. Sorry, I can't do the Eli Trump voice there, but there you go. 4 of 20, tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 69. Another 2 Live Crew reference. Be one of the cool kids, become a patron. Yeah, absolutely. Do that. Aaron Grady, Aaron Golliver. New rule, top patrons can't be murdered by OA Facebook group admins, Emily. great rule. I meant I would be recording our conversations, Mr. President. Jeremiah broke his fancy microwave and is very sad. Well, we're sad on your behalf, but you know what? Start doing that reheating on the stove, man. It's better. Microwaves are good for children and popcorn. That's it. Dave, living
Sorry,
life, Yodel
you don't
Mountain
mean
High.
Putting children in them, right? Because that's kind of what it sounded yeah. like.
I mean, if you have children in your household okay. who need to reheat food, the microwave is good for that. And it is good for popcorn and is not good for much else. Boiling water. It's good for boiling water, except for the cavitation thing. So anyway, Dave, living life Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America. Mitchell, your mom is a fee simple. Give Lydia a segment like Lucinda has on Scathing. I continue to be a huge fan of that. We gotta make that happen. I, Aaron Rabbi, hereby state that Picard is the best captain. Does he not? Oh, I think that's a clear round winner there. Wells Fargo only lets you own things fee complicated. And our top patron, our Hall of Fame of Hall of Famer, Conrad Michaels. Thanks to all of you for supporting us over at patreon.com/law. Also, we've recently updated the Hall of Fame page. Now, you know, it changes every day because you people are nuts and we love you. if you didn't previously see your name on our Hall of Fame page, go check it out. You should see it.
Oh, so great. That was fun. Thank you, guys. And now it's time to see if I can, pick myself up by my bootstraps here and get a question right. Hopefully, hey, not a real property question, maybe?
Yeah, okay. We're going to do a contracts question, and you've done pretty well at contracts law. So let's see how it goes. All right.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
During negotiations to purchase a used car, a buyer asked a dealer whether the car had ever been in an accident. The dealer replied, "It is a fine car and has been thoroughly inspected and comes with a certificate of assured quality. Feel free to have the car inspected by your own mechanic."
Hmm.
In actuality, the car had been in a major accident, and the dealer had repaired and repainted the car, successfully concealing evidence of the accident. The buyer declined to have the car inspected by his own mechanic, explaining that he would rely on the dealer's certificate of assured quality. At no time did the dealer disclose that the car had previously been in an accident. The parties then signed a contract of sale. After the car was delivered and paid for, the buyer learned that the car had been in a major accident. If the buyer sues the dealer to rescind the transaction, is the buyer likely to succeed?
Gosh.
A? No, because the buyer had the opportunity to have the car inspected by his own mechanic and declined to do so. B, no, because the dealer did not affirmatively assert that the car had not been in an accident. C, yes, because the contract was unconscionable. Or D, yes, because the dealer's statement was intentionally misleading and the dealer concealed evidence of the accident.
Oh, man. Okay, so this is one of those ones where I think a naive, the law is designed to screw people over. One of those kind of mindsets would lead you to believe that this is totally fine. But I think there's quite a few protections for stuff like this, usually. But is this going to be one of those cases? As upon reading this question or hearing you read it, I was thinking maybe this is one of those times where by a technicality, you know, the guy can squeeze through because he said you can feel free to have it inspected by your own mechanic. Oh, it's close, but upon looking at the answers, I would have no way of differentiating between A and B. So the no answers, which are no, because the buyer had the opportunity to have the car inspected, and no, because the dealer did not affirmatively assert the car had not been an accident. I don't know how I would decide between those, you know, like maybe it's possible that there's some legally way, contract law way that those are different, but I'm leaning toward a yes answer because, you know, not, maybe you can think I'm naive, but I think most of our contracts questions have usually protected the buyer or whoever more than you would think. And I think that this is pretty misleading. And honestly, I'm going to just have to bank on this being a straightforward one and go with D, yes, because the dealer's statement was intentionally misleading and the dealer concealed evidence of the accident. C, yes, because the contract was unconscionable. Now, I know unconscionable is language that we've used in this before. That's definitely, I'm pretty sure that's a real thing. Like contract, if it is unconscionable, then that, you know, that's definitely valid. But I don't think that I would put this contract, you know, in the unconscionable realm because the car is delivered, you know, it has been inspected and yes, it's been in an accident before, but it's not as though they delivered just a pile of junk. It's just, there was information that they didn't have. So I don't know about unconscionable and it doesn't seem like, you know, it was some outlandish price or something like that. So that's why I'm going to eliminate C. Nah, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to eliminate A and B because I have no way of determining which one of those would be a better answer. So I'm going to go radical and eliminate both the no answers. And I'm going to choose D because this dealer statement was intentionally misleading and the dealer concealed evidence of an accident. I hope that's what it is. But that would definitely mean this question was incredibly straightforward, and I always get nervous when I go with the incredibly straightforward answer, but you know what? Often it is that. So That's my answer. Final answer D, eliminating A and B. And I think C is a good distractor, but I don't think it's quite right. That's my final.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your guests, your reasons, therefore. And we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much, Andrew, for all the research and the spelunking on Yodel Mountain. Or I always say that. And the climbing on Yodel Mountain we do. We'll spelunk when we go on our way down. And this is, wow, another almost 1.5 episodes. Don't say Andrew never did anything for you. And we will see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.